Good day. You're listening to European Buddha.
So, welcome to the European Buddha podcast. In this episode, we're diving into the European Buddhist Union, exploring not only its many activities, the core, or one of the cores, the work of its council. Hello, Manisha.
Hello there.
Member of the Triratna Buddhist Order and newly vice president of the EBU.
Yes, how grand.
Yes. Hello again.
Hello, nice to be with you again.
And hello, Emilia. And I just wanted to say, congratulations, Emilia. Finland has been crowned the world's happiest country for the seventh successive year in the newly released World Happiness Report.
That is right. And hello to everyone. Hey, Manisha, willkommen.
Hey. Yes, and I just want to say, although I'm British, I live in Sweden, which I think was number four in the happiness,
exactly.
happiness ranking.
Manisha, what do you think that makes us happy here in North?
I think that we have we have lots of open space, don't we? We're not overcrowded.
Yes.
And the two countries, Sweden and Finland, both have a very strong outdoor culture, which means that we're on probably above averagely healthy population.
Exactly.
With an excellent quality of life.
Yeah.
Very good working conditions, social democracy. Not so much now, unfortunately, but we have a history of social democracy.
Exactly.
And a very good, probably what is usually known as work-life balance.
What do you think, Emilia, why that is?
I totally agree with what Manisha said. Nature, space, safety.
And free childcare.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I know, being British, is a tremendous difficulty for a lot of working parents.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's true. Yes, I feel like in Finland we have a culture of when you have family kids, you are kind of supported in a nice way.
So very important to think about the framework of happiness, or what are the conditions of happiness?
The one thing my teacher Sangharakshita said when he visited New Zealand, which some of us think has some things in common with life in Sweden, he said, the only problem is that life here is so enjoyable that you have less incentive to practice the Dharma.
That explains a lot.
Yeah, and certainly Sweden is if you look at the way they measure life in different countries around the world, Sweden is the most irreligious country, I think, in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Religion is almost viewed as embarrassing.
Mm.
But Buddhism is regarded as better than the others. You don't need to broadcast that.
Yeah, interesting. And with that, I don't know if I should say it to you, but congratulations to your new role as Vice President of the European Buddhist Union. How does that feel? Has something changed?
Yes, I have more work to do. I do have now. Initially, the first few months, there wasn't anything particular to do. And so we're still a very new council. Almost all of us were not on the council before last September, so we're learning how to work together.
Mm.
And we're also making some changes, so we have decided to go to a new cycle of meetings, partly for environmental reasons, because we don't think it's really acceptable for people to travel from all over Europe to be at a physical meeting every single year. So we are proposing to go over to alternate years, having physical meetings, and in between having online meetings. But apart from that, I mean, we're just getting on with our business. We're meeting more or less every month, learning how to work together, how to take forward various projects, how to find money for our exciting projects as well. We're not a rich organization. We have no rich donors. We're dependent on the finances of our member organizations, and most Buddhist organizations are short of money.
So it's about continuing the valuable work that is already being worked on.
Yeah.
And have you had time to negotiate, discuss about some focus?
Yes, I think they're, at the moment, they're about continuing projects that we've already begun. So one of them is a project that you have already done a podcast on, Windows into Buddhism, which is a website about Buddhism for teachers, religious education teachers in schools across Europe. So it's not a site for children. It's a site for teachers who are teaching in normal mainstream schools, children of all faiths or no faith, where Buddhism is part of the school curriculum. So this site makes teaching materials, you know, by Buddhists who are also pedagogically trained, so school teachers themselves, which are really practically useful in the classroom, free materials. It's called Windows into Buddhism. And one of the things that we're finding is that, you know, teachers in schools very often, they don't have any money to buy teaching materials. So they go onto YouTube to look for Buddhist materials, which are not made for children or for school. Mm-hmm. They're made for Buddhists, and they're very variable quality. And they also may be quite sectarian because they're made for Buddhists of a particular tradition. They don't intend to be sectarian, but they just are. So these materials are made to be non-sectarian, as far as we can do that, as far as we are aware. Mm-hmm. It's always possible to make mistakes through ignorance. They're made by Buddhists. Some materials are made by religious education specialists who are not Buddhists, and you can really, really feel the difference. So we're looking for new money to continue that project so we can continue to develop the site. And the particular focus for the future of the site is materials on socially engaged Buddhism. So Buddhism and the environment, Buddhism and climate change. Children of all faiths and no faith need a lot of help to understand what's going on and how we can best respond to the climate crisis.
Is this material translated into different European country languages?
The deal is that we have our particular strength is Buddhism in English and classroom teaching.
Yeah.
So, but the arrangement is that these materials are completely free, and the Buddhist unions, the national Buddhist unions in each country, can have the materials free of charge, and they can translate them and do whatever they like with them, in fact, to make them suitable for the language and curriculum of their countries, or languages and curriculums of their countries sometimes. No. But there's a lot of, I think we really do want to showcase the work that so many Buddhist organizations do around the world, you know, in the relief of poverty, schools for children who have no money, families who have no money in Nepal, for example, education for girls, all the work that was done on caring for people with AIDS by Theravadin monks, which no one knows about, you know, all that kind of thing. There's a huge amount of Buddhist social work that has no public profile at all. And then we get a reputation for just sitting on our cushions and feeling peaceful. And all the peace work that's done by Buddhists. You know, so we really want to develop some materials for children that shows that kind of work in progress. They're like the fruits of our practice on the cushion out in the world. There's another project also which is looking at improving security for faith, well, places of worship, I suppose, in Europe. As you know, tensions are rising between different faith groups. Usually this doesn't include Buddhists, but it does sometimes, for example, when people hear about what is happening in Burma, where Buddhist, sort of ethnically Buddhist groups are persecuting ethnically Muslim groups. That can have repercussions here in Europe. There's sort of revenge attacks, that kind of thing. So there's a European project called SASCE, S-A-S-C-E, which is looking at helping faith groups to improve their security and protect themselves from harm. That's not a specifically Buddhist project, but we may have some input into that.
And you have some input in that.
Yes.
Also in the other context, where we interviewed you with an episode and introduced your work as a safeguarding police and ethical standards implementer.
That's a little bit different, but it's to do with ethics within Buddhist sanghas.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
What I was talking about, SASCE is more about protecting places of worship from public opinion, you know, what people think about Buddhists because of what they've heard on the news. But yes, I left my job last summer as the central safeguarding officer for the Triratna Buddhist Order and community. Mm-hmm. We're developing policies and procedures for when things... when there are complaints, whether you know, whether they're sound or not, about how we take them seriously and look into them and act appropriately. I don't do that work anymore in Triratna, but in the European Buddhist Union, we've also thought it was very important to start to raise ethical standards. I mean, obviously, we need good standards within the running of the union itself, But we also want to encourage higher ethical standards in all the member organisations, because unfortunately, as in the rest of life, there are sometimes complaints about the behaviour of particularly Buddhist teachers and leaders with lay Buddhists or their student Buddhists. This can happen in any tradition whatsoever, and it has done, and sometimes it's very serious, and sometimes it's not not criminal, but it's still not okay. And so in the EBU, we have the EBU Ethics Committee, which is a small group of women and men from different countries and different Buddhist traditions who've we've got together. We've created a statement of our ethical, our code of conduct, and how we will proceed when a complaint is brought to us. Now, happily, we've had almost no complaints at all.
Is this a good sign, or is this the sign
Well,
that we can develop?
good. Yes. From our point of view, of course, because we're normal human beings who would like to have less to do, we like the fact there have been fewer complaints, and I hope that that indicates that, on the whole, people are running their sanghas, their Buddhist communities, in a kind and generous and thoughtful way. It could, of course, mean that things are going on which we're not being told. We have to allow for that. On the other hand, of course, it takes time to develop such a group and its capacity and its understanding of the work. So I'm very happy if we proceed slowly and receive very few. It could also mean, of course, that the individual groups themselves are handling their own complaints very well. They only come to the EBU if the individual group is not thought to have done its work properly. And actually, the complaints, the tiny number of complaints that have come to us, have been passed to us. Let me think about this. Sometimes they're passed to us not because someone is dissatisfied, but because the national union, the National Buddhist Union, in the country where this complaint has arisen, has felt it was responsible and ethical just to tell us that this is happening in their country. It's not that they want us to do something about it. They want to be open. They want to say, this is happening and you need to know about it, because it could affect how Buddhists are seen as well, how Buddhism is seen. We need to take care of the good name of the Buddha Dharma. We need to take care of people. That's the first thing, obviously. Then we need to take care of the reputation of the Buddha Dharma. And there is dukkha. We cannot make everything okay, but we can do the best we can to be responsible and ask the right questions. And not all things can be resolved by the police. If the complainant doesn't want to go to the police or doesn't want to pursue their case in court, then nothing can be done. But the organisation can still do something about the person who is alleged to have caused the harm. Of course, one thing we have to remember, in my experience, is that most of these difficult situations are not caused by teachers or leaders in Buddhist traditions. We have a bit of a fixation about Buddhist teachers and, poor ethics. In my experience, a lot of these difficulties arise between the students or the lay people, however you describe them in your tradition. But actually, if you run a sangha, you almost always have problems between people who come to the sangha. Teachers may be great. So that's the work we're doing, gradually developing our ability to understand how to work with these problems. And people often say, you need to tell us about this work. You need to be open and transparent. As if openness and transparency was in itself a Buddhist value. Actually, I'd say it's neutral, because openness and transparency can cause a lot of harm. If you've been the victim of a crime, you don't want everyone to know about it. So I would make a difference between confidentiality and cover-up. They're completely different things. Confidentiality means we do quietly exactly everything that needs to be done with consideration and thoughtfulness and diligence. But we don't tell everybody what we're doing for the sake of all the people involved in the complaint.
Yeah, for me, it's a very valuable work that seems to be needed. Also, when we speak so often about the transition from Buddhism from the East to the West, of course, there's same problems on the same sides, you could say.
Absolutely.
But it's very interesting when we come to the European Union and all the national Buddhist unions. We have resources, we have knowledge how to address these problems. And as you said, it is really about safeguarding the reputation of Buddhism.
Well, of course, the best way to safeguard the reputation of Buddhism is to develop ethical standards, and then when things still go wrong anyway, as they do because we're humans, address the difficulties honestly and effectively. Unfortunately, some people think the best way to safeguard the reputation of the Buddha Dharma is to pretend things haven't happened, which obviously is a very short-term solution. because eventually the truth comes out.
Could you say a few words about ethics? Because you're an expert of ethics. How did you get interested in ethics in the first place? And how do you study or learn it?
And no, I wouldn't call myself an expert on ethics. I would just say that I'm very interested in it, and
Exactly.
it's the reason I became a Buddhist. Was growing up as a young woman and knowing that I was lesbian, I was kind of, and I thought, well, it doesn't seem to be anything wrong with this, but religious teachings, Christian religious teachers seem to be, at best, they're ambivalent, and at worst, they're very condemnatory and say that this is a sin and, not acceptable and there's something wrong with you. And then I encountered the five precepts of Buddhism, and I thought, wow, what a great code. I was very interested actually in how to, as a young woman in my 20s, how to live a meaningful life. And I just thought, what a great code of ethics. It covers everything, the five precepts. It doesn't matter whether you're white or black, Asian, rich, poor, educated, uneducated. It doesn't matter if it's 2,000 years ago or now, you can live by the five precepts. And they clearly apply as much to LGBT people as anyone else.
Can you recall them? So what are
The
the
five
five
precepts. The
precepts?
first of the five precepts is to avoid killing or causing harm, which in Sri Ratna we would also interpret in the positive, which is to develop loving kindness. The second of the five precepts is to avoid taking things that haven't been freely given and cultivate generosity. The third is to avoid causing harm through your sexual behavior. And in Sri Ratna, we would also say it's about cultivating stillness, simplicity, and contentment. It's the opposite of sexual misconduct. And the fourth precept is about truthful communication, which we could also say is about true, kind, helpful, harmonious communication if we unpack it a bit. And the fourth one is to avoid causing harm through a lack of mindfulness due to alcohol or drugs, so recreational drugs, for example. So cultivating clarity and awareness of self and others. And they really do cover everything. You can unpack them. In fact, in the order that I'm part of, the Tri Ratna order, we do unpack them into 10 precepts, which are also found in the Pali scriptures. But they're all part of the same five, the original five. The difficulty you have, of course, in small groups of people running any organization is that when someone is alleged to have done something really awful, or very unethical, you can think that really taking firm action about it isn't kind and is therefore a breach of the first precept. And you could say, oh, well, they said they were sorry. In fact, they even made a confession. In my tradition, we have confession. So they've made a confession, they've acknowledged they've really fallen short of their ideals, and now we should just let it go. And the problem with that is that it does nothing for the person who is harmed unless you also make amends. You meet them, you say, I can see how much I harmed you, I'm so sorry. And of course, if it's criminal, that also means going to court and, accepting the consequences. And nobody in a small organization wants to see their teacher or their friend in that situation. So there's always a temptation to try and forgive and sort of make it okay a bit too quickly and easily in a way that minimizes the true significance of the offense or the harm for the person who was harmed. And that's the big challenge for us as Buddhists, and not just for Buddhists. It's the same in all religions and in most organizations.
And I was just thinking if we have developed some kind of societal awareness that is also supported by certain procedures, how to address things, then it might be also for the individual not such a scary thing. They are encouraged to really reflect, to really reflect and reflect and reflect. If we can do that together in a very beneficial way, then it's really,
Well, it's Dharma practice,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah.
I
Sounds
would see it as
familiar.
Dharma
Yes.
practice. It's part of what we're doing as Buddhists. But of course, to do it is a very painful, it can be a very deep and painful process, and you want to do it with the minimum of publicity.
Yeah.
A person needs a small group around them of trusted friends who can really look into these things with them in a very supportive and kind environment, without lots of external comment and criticism and Facebook and Twitter, which is why we do these things quietly. Because the product, the result, we want to be that people have deeply learnt and that they, that they are transformed by the process. Not that they are shamed publicly in front of the entire world, which is not growthful. Shame is a crippling experience, and it doesn't help people make progress towards enlightenment. So, I mean, there's a kind of healthy, hri. Hri is a Buddhist term for a kind of healthy sense of shame, as you really acknowledge I have fallen short of my own values. I'm deeply sorry. It's embarrassing and painful. And at least I only have to go through this in front of some very close people, a close group of people who have my best interests at heart and have not forgotten the best interests of the victim as well. Because it's easy to create a group of friends who just say, poor you, you fell short, and forget the victim.
But what a healing experience it is for all the people involved in it when there is a safe space where you can sort things out and learn.
Safe and challenging space.
Yes,
Not too safe.
brave.
You know, safety of collusion is not helpful.
And with all that work in mind that you are involved in my preparation for this interview, I read that you have a retreat hut in Sweden.
Yes,
And
we do.
I was wondering, is there any time within when you're already occupied with work when you're just yearning for that simplicity?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I thought you were going to say, is there any time when it's free and you can come and have a retreat?
Of course, this also, yes.
That's the second question.
Yes, yes. My wife and I have a torp, which is a Swedish word for an old farmhouse, just outside Stockholm on an island in Lake Mälaren, which is a large inland lake. And part of the property is a small stuga, which is a little wooden house, which we use it for holidays also, but people do rent it for small solitary retreats or little holidays. And yes, we do. We spend half our time in Stockholm, working quite hard at the Stockholm Buddhist Center and our work, and then we long to get away to the farmhouse and we and meditate and study together and garden and. It has a lot of forest on it. It's a really typical Swedish property. It has 10 hectares of meadow and forest. I'm not saying everybody has 10 hectares, but I'm just saying if you have land in Sweden, you probably have a lot of forest on
Yeah.
it and a
Or
lot
at
of
least you
gardening.
know someone who has.
And we have small group retreats there occasionally, but mainly it's just it's for us and for our individual people doing kind of solitary retreats there.
Yeah, I think there needs to be definitely more studies or surveys about the happiness about the in the Scandinavian area.
Has to be fair and say that there are a lot of poor people in Sweden as well who are suffering and living in tiny little flats in high-rise blocks in three-generational households. And it's not a perfect country by any means, but many of us are very, very fortunate.
Thank you, Monisha. It's been so nice to have you here with us today. And last time you were as our guest, we talked about karma, and we learned that everything we do has an effect on ourselves and people around us, and actually everything, not just around us, but the whole planet. You shared a very nice practice with us last time, and would you have a little practice to share with us today?
Yeah, we can do maybe a few minutes of metta bhavana, loving kindness meditation. We'll do a little shortened version of that. So,
Perfect.
yes. Take a few moments to sit upright. Not too upright, we don't want to be stiff, but just sitting tall. Coming the sense of yourself sitting here on your chair after all this chat. The way your body feels, breathing, taking a few deep breaths, and looking for any sense of positivity, any sense of well-being in your experience right now. Maybe you're happy, contented, interested. Or maybe you just have a feeling of warmth in your hands. But you can just let that positivity, just let it grow. Imagine this sense of well-being or positivity or warmth filling your whole being. And wishing yourself well. However you are now, wishing for yourself kindness, contentment, well-being. You could even imagine breathing in a sense of happiness and kindness, and breathing out kindness, care and concern for the world around you. Wherever you are. Breathing in warmth and well-being. Breathing out kindness and care for others. And staying that way with the breath for a few moments. And then just coming back to a sense of the room around you and opening your eyes and bringing the meditation to a close.
Thank you, Manisha.
Thank you.
That was lovely.
I hope you can make something nice out of that.
I was just thinking that it was just very condensed what we actually were talking about.
Yes, it was.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you for that
Good.
gift. Yeah.
Great.
I really love this idea of taking things into action. And thank you for that. It's not just about sitting on our cushions, but
It's really important.
yes.
We say in my tradition that when you take refuge, when you go, we say go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, that is expressed practically in the practice of the precepts. The precepts are the practical expression of refuge. Thank you. That was nice
Thank you
talking
very
to
much.
you.